if you remember just how many home foreclosures there were during the recession. The good news is those days are far behind us. But Illinois still has one of the highest foreclosure rates in the country. And as far as cities go, Rockford and Peoria are in the top 10. Today, we'll look at why. Plus, more and more companies are using artificial intelligence to find the best candidate for the job, but critics warn they're only finding the same candidates. And Illinois residents know all about how Asian carp have been infesting our rivers. The U of I even once had a catered lunch serving Asian carp on the menu.
All my life I've been saying, you know, don't eat carp. Well, it tasted really good, and it tasted like cod or tilapia.
Well, now two Chicagoans have found another market for Asian carp by turning it into pet food. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. We'll get started after the latest news. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up this hour, how two Chicago area entrepreneurs have turned Illinois' Asian carp problem into a business. We're also going to be looking at the ways employers are increasingly using technology to help find prospective employees and why blood donations are down this summer and what you can do to help. But first, we heard a lot about foreclosures during the Great Recession. Thankfully, we haven't heard as much these days. But new numbers just out from Adam Data Solutions show that Illinois' foreclosure rate is well above the national average. And of the top 10 metro areas in the country that had the highest rates of foreclosure, there were two Illinois towns on the list, Peoria and Rockford. In a few minutes, we're going to be speaking with realtors from those areas, but let's start with Darren Blomquist. He's a senior vice president at Adam Data Solutions, which has been collecting these numbers. They're also the company behind Realty Track, if that name is familiar to you. Hi, Darren. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi, Nyla. Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
Yeah, let's start with this data. So you all released a mid-year report on the number of home foreclosures. That number was 23,000 in the first half of 2018. What does that number tell you?
Yes, and that was for the statewide in Illinois. That number, it probably sounds pretty large, 23,000 homes, but it's actually down. It's not too bad, it's down 20% from a year ago, so we're seeing a trend in the right direction. But it's still, we're talking about tens of thousands of homeowners who are being affected by foreclosure in Illinois. And when we look at it not just as a raw number, but as a percentage of housing units, that's where we see the rate of foreclosure activity in Illinois is ranking number four in the country, fourth highest behind number one is New Jersey, Delaware, and Maryland are the top three. And so there's some good news, bad news really here is that foreclosure activity is coming down 20%. And it's down, if we look at the peak of the housing crisis in 2010, it's down 73% from that point. But still an elevated level of foreclosure activity in Illinois compared to the rest of the country.
And Darren, I know the reasons for this are probably somewhat complex, but I want to just first ask you about the cycle of real estate. Were we, as Illinois, does it seem like we were slower to get out of a downward dip, even though we're still improving? Is it maybe that we had a slower improvement than other parts of the country?
Yes, absolutely. That's part of the equation here is that Illinois took longer to clear out the distress left over from the housing bubble and subsequent burst. And so that cleanup time period was longer for Illinois, and there's a few reasons for that. But that ultimately is part of the reason why we see this still elevated foreclosure rate. Now, particularly in the storyline is just a little bit different in Peoria when we look at the data because we do see some more recent distress entering the mix there in terms of more recent foreclosure starts. But for most of the state, this elevated rate still ties back, unfortunately, to the last housing boom and bust.
And Darren, is that because of the legal process? I know during the recession, it was taking a long time for courts to go through and the process of distressed properties was just took a long time. Is that still true in Illinois?
Yes, that's part of the reason we saw that long tail of distress take longer to clean up in Illinois. It's what's called a judicial foreclosure state that just in about half the states are like that. Inherently, it takes longer to process foreclosures, especially when you have a high volume of foreclosures. because each foreclosure becomes a court case that goes before a judge, and so there's a little bit more manual oversight of the foreclosure cases, which can be good, a good thing for the homeowners to make sure that homeowners are protected against improper foreclosure, but it also slows down the process of working through those foreclosures, and that's part of the reason. And then you also had some proactive, beyond just that basic process in Illinois, you did have some more proactive attempts by judges and others and even sheriffs to slow down foreclosures to make sure they were being done properly when the system was overwhelmed with the high number of foreclosures we were seeing back in 2010. And by the way, just to give you that number, it's 23,000 now. Back in 2010, in the first half of that year, which was the peak, we saw 74,000 properties with foreclosure filings.
Wow! So almost it's three times the amount, almost.
That's right.
Right. I wanted to ask you, Darren, about the numbers. So you all released numbers as you were talking about the rates of foreclosure, the top 10 metro areas that had the highest rates of foreclosure. You mentioned Peoria. Rockford was also on that list. Are there things those areas have in common based on the data, what you're seeing for why we're seeing the highest rates of foreclosures in those parts of Illinois?
It's actually a little bit different storyline in the two cities. And then actually, I should mention also Chicago is down at number 11, so it's just below the top 10, but it's pretty high up there on the list out of the 219 metropolitan areas that we looked at. And when this might get a little wonky in terms of the data, but we look at the data, the foreclosures broken down by the loan date, the date that the loan was originated, and that tells us something about when the distress is from. And in Chicago and Rockford, less than half of the properties that are in foreclosure are tied to loans that were originated since the recession ended, so from 2010 onward. Less than half of the loans are tied to that. More than a higher percentage are tied back to either during the recession or prior to the recession.
Those loans. So loans that were made before the recession, that's what we're seeing foreclosures based on, is what you're saying.
Those are, yeah, that's more heavily tilted toward those pre-recession and during the recession loans in Chicago and Rockford. In Peoria, it's a little different story. You know, there's some of those in the mix as well, for sure. But over what stands out there to me is that over 50% of the foreclosures in Peoria are tied to loans originated since the end of the recession, since 2010 and onward, which nationwide, we're showing 41% of loans are tied to post-recession, or foreclosures are tied to post-recession loans, because so it's a much higher percentage in Peoria. The loans after the recession have, for the most part, performed pretty well, because lenders actually, at least have so far, learned their lesson and are not originating the crazy loans that we saw during the last housing bubble. But something's going on in Peoria, and I think it's probably likely tied to some of the economic distress, specifically some of the job layoffs there that we've seen in the last couple of years, that is causing some of these loans to go bad, even though the loans aren't inherently the kind of toxic loan products that we saw back before the recession.
We're speaking with Darren Blomquist. He's the senior vice president with Adam Data Solutions about their mid-year foreclosure national report that's been out. He's been sharing with us the data. Let's bring in the picture from someone who's based locally in the Rockford area. Larry Holin is a managing broker at Pioneer Real Estate. Hi, Larry. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi, Nyla. Thanks for having me on.
Larry, were you surprised that Rockford was named in this report for being one of the top 10 metro areas for foreclosure rates in the country?
Well, I can't say that I'm surprised. I'm a little disappointed. I can tell you that I've been involved in the foreclosure world for a number of years. And as being echoed in that report, I'm seeing the volume of properties coming down, but there is still a steady trickle of foreclosed properties that comes into our inventory every week.
And Larry, are there particular parts of Rockford where we're seeing more foreclosures than others? Is this concentrated in specific parts of the metro area?
You would think that the foreclosure market would be hit hardest in first-time home buyer markets because those homeowners may not have the resources to withstand financial hardship, whether it's short-term or medium-term hardship. But we're seeing inventory in all areas of this MSA. So we'll see properties in the $30,000 price range up to $250,000, and there doesn't seem to be a real rhyme or reason as to point to one direction that this is the segment that's struggling. It's the struggle is throughout the market.
And what about in smaller towns near Rockford? Are you seeing lots of foreclosures there as well?
Yeah, our territory extends west to the Mississippi River, so into that Freeport around the U.S. 20 corridor, and then south in the Dixon market, Rochelle, and we're seeing steady inventory in all of those small towns that surround those areas.
Larry, I wanted to ask you about the condition of these homes. Previously, and I think particularly during the Great Recession, we saw distressed properties, and a lot of folks knew that if they were buying some of them were in pretty bad shape. What are you seeing across the foreclosure landscape across Rockford?
Well, what I can tell you is that back in the early 2010, 2011 era, properties were coming into inventory that maybe had been vacant for 2 years, some even longer. And those properties were in pretty rough condition and would be primarily sold to investors that wanted to either flip them or convert them to rentals. Now we're seeing properties that have only been vacant maybe for 3 months, 6 months. Some are still occupied up until the time they go out to the market. And so the property condition is much better. But I can also tell you that the servicers out there, the owners of these properties, are taking a more keen interest in them and are investing a lot of money in repairing these properties. So you might see houses with new roofs, with freshly painted interiors, new kitchens, new mechanicals, furnaces, air conditioners, etc. So they're making the investment in the property, and that's done in an effort to help stabilize and restore some of these neighborhoods that have been hardest hit with foreclosures.
And so just to make sure I'm understanding you correctly, Larry, you're seeing that now with properties that are just coming on the market, homeowners who previously had tried to improve the property.
No, the banks are doing
that. The banks are doing that.
Once the bank takes ownership of the property, we'll assess the property and provide a recommendation that the property would be best sold as is or best sold as repaired. And so we're seeing that the banks are making investments in a lot of these properties in an effort to maximize their return, but also in an effort to help stabilize and restore neighborhoods.
Darren, are we seeing that across the country, what Larry's talking about in terms of banks investing in distressed properties a little bit more?
We've heard more common is that banks are taking advantage of the fact that the market's recovering, the housing market overall, and it's a great time to be a seller. And so they're taking advantage of that and leveraging that and realizing that in some instances they're going to get more bang for their buck if they improve those properties and sell them, as Larry said, after repairs as opposed to kind of the as-is condition that we saw very common during the recession.
Larry, to Darren's point about it's a great seller's market, I wonder what advice you have for first-time home buyers, maybe people who are maybe now interested in buying and are just now trying to wrap their heads around all of this information, whether it's foreclosures or the market in general. Larry, what advice do you have for folks?
So as a first-time home buyer, the market is extremely competitive. It's not uncommon to see a foreclosed property or even a retail property experience multiple offers at the time it comes to the market. So very quickly after it's on the market, multiple offers are received. And a home buyer, particularly a first-time home buyer, inexperienced home buyer, needs to be armed with a pre-approval, needs to be working with an experienced individual that can help them navigate through that negotiation process. And as it relates to foreclosures, a lot of these foreclosure companies, banks, the Fannie Mae's, the Freddie Mac's of the world, are making the process much easier. So it's not this daunting, very complex process that it used to be. Much easier to buy a foreclosed property and understand what you're buying.
And so, Larry, would you recommend that first-time home buyers look at foreclosed properties? It sounds like you would.
Absolutely. Yeah, they can be a tremendous investment for a first-time home buyer. As long as the first-time home buyer does their due diligence, they perform a home inspection, they do all the other inspections that you would encourage them to do on a retail property, radon test, termite test, you have roof inspections, mechanical inspections, things like that. And that is something that all sellers are going to provide to a buyer, the ability to do a home inspection so that they're armed with the best information that's available.
Darren, we just have about a minute left, but I just wanted to ask you about the state of the real estate market across Illinois in general. We've been talking about foreclosures. Obviously, a lot of this relates to the job market and how well the employment and labor situation looks like across Illinois. In general, how would you rate Illinois' real estate market compared to the rest of the country?
Oh, that's a tough one. But, you know, I would probably put it below par, unfortunately, and just looking at the numbers we look at in terms of the recovery. Now, certainly the market is bouncing back. Home prices are up, continuing to increase. But one of the things I look at, and unfortunately I don't have this in front of me for Rockford and Peoria, but for Chicago, even though home prices have been coming back, they're still 7% below the pre-recession peak. Whereas nationwide, we're showing home prices have now exceeded the pre-recession peak and are 6% above. So just by that measurement, it's, you know, along with the foreclosures, it's taken Illinois
right still lagging
longer to get back.
Right. It
yeah.
sounds like we're still lagging in the cycle, like we were talking about before. Well, both of you, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me. Darren Blomquist is a senior vice president with Adam Data Solutions. We'll tweet out that mid-year report for people who are interested on foreclosures. And I want to thank Larry Holand for being with us as well. He's a managing broker with Pioneer Real Estate in Rockford and a member of the Rockford Realtors Association. Gentlemen, thank you for being with me.
Thank you, Nyla.
You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're going to continue our business theme conversation by talking about jobs. If you spent any time looking for a new job recently, then you know that technology makes it a lot easier. Perhaps you're an employer looking for new candidates. There are online search tools and networking sites like LinkedIn. You can conduct interviews via Skype. You can use the web to search for tips on everything, on resume templates to how to dress to impress. Technology has also become so sophisticated that many companies are now using artificial intelligence to filter through those resumes, even answer applicant questions. But think about all the controversy surrounding Facebook's algorithm when it comes to determining our news feed. Now, think about using other algorithms to determine who gets a job interview. Alexia Alejandre Ruiz recently reported on this for the Chicago Tribune. She joins us now, along with Jeffrey Blumenfeld, who's on the line with us. He's the director of Career Moves at JVS Chicago. They provide career counseling and exploration services. We've also got Tony Lee with us from the Society for Human Resource Management. All of you, welcome to the 21st. Good morning. Thanks for being here with me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Alexia, I wanted to start with you and your story. I mentioned a couple things, LinkedIn, video interviews. Can you tell us some of the other ways that technology and artificial intelligence is being used in hiring?
Yeah, so we're kind of at the start of it. So some of the ways that we're starting to see it are, for example, little chat tools on a company's career site that allow people to apply for jobs using kind of just like natural language, so they don't have to necessarily upload a resume. They can instead, you know, the little chat bot asks them, like, you know, when are you available, for example, if you're applying for a restaurant job? Are you over 18? Stuff like that, so you can kind of have a back and forth with a little robot. And it's supposed to, the idea is that it can understand your language and, you know, ask relevant follow-up questions. And then there are other ways, you know, there for companies that are searching for like passive candidates. They'll put like web crawlers that'll just search all the publicly available information to search for people who might be appropriate for a role, and then they compile kind of a database of potential candidates. And then the other way that I think is one of the more interesting and also one of the more controversial ways is in these hiring algorithms that companies are using, to in which they analyze their existing top performers at their work and create an algorithm based on that, and then have and then look for people or evaluate candidates based on that information to find similar people, people with similar traits, so that they can find the best fit for the company.
I want to get to those hiring algorithms, back to that in a moment, Alexia. But can I first ask you, I was surprised to learn from your story that job applicants are in some cases even video recording themselves answering interview questions. How common is that?
Yeah, so when I spoke with a man, actually, who Jeff at JVS put me in touch with, he was saying that on frequently, like it's not uncommon for him to have to get on, you know, do an interview with the computer, basically, so the computer spits automated questions at him, and he has like 2 minutes to think about it, and then he has 40 seconds to answer, or the other way around, and then, you know, the computer spits the next question at him, and stuff like that, and so he's being recorded, so they're seeing him, you know, how he speaks and how he responds and everything like that, but he doesn't have anybody else on the other side.
Jeff, as you're working to train people looking for jobs, I wonder how that's changed and how you're helping people navigate this new digital culture.
I think there are a number of factors that are involved that make it extremely helpful and useful for individuals in terms of the speed at which people can access information and the variety of information that's available. But on the downside, there are a number of individuals who find that technology is intimidating, and that can be a very difficult process, especially in terms of some of the means in which you were just discussing that people are accessing an interview process. So, for instance, an individual who would be well-rehearsed and feel comfortable being able to speak to a blank screen and answer questions would have no problem and would probably do very well. There's some individuals who, like myself, I have a very difficult time because I find it really important to pick up on the cues that we get from seeing a person and from interacting with people. So it's a real mixed bag at this point in time.
And I wonder, Tony, if you can weigh in here from SHRM's perspective, the Society of Human Resource Management, why are companies using tools like this? Is it just to make the process a little bit more cost efficient as well as efficient overall?
Well, it's not necessarily cost efficient. It's more reacting to an incredible talent shortage that's going on, you know, nationwide and beyond. Companies are struggling to fill a number of positions from hourly to the executive suite. And just to try and keep up with that demand, HR is doing everything it can to identify qualified candidates and then get through the process of having them interviewed and approved and hired as quickly as possible. Every empty position that's not filled costs companies money. And so they're very motivated to try and find the best fits and get them in place as quickly as possible. So as a result, you'll see companies adopt the technologies that we're talking about to try and speed the process. I mean, Amazon's a great example of one that's leading the way in terms of a number of their positions. Candidates are offered jobs before they've ever met anyone in person. They have tests that they can take online to prove their skills in a certain area. A lot of it's IT, but others as well. And if they score to a certain level, the next message they see on their screen is, congratulations, would you like to come work for us? So, you know, companies need to do what they can in this environment to try and identify and hire folks as quickly and efficiently as they can.
Alexia, as Tony is describing this, I wonder, I immediately just think, are there legal issues with doing that? Or what other pitfalls did you find in your reporting from this digitization of the job process?
Right. So a risk in creating the algorithms, for example, is that the training set that you use to train the algorithm, meaning the original employee sample, you know, whether that has bias baked into it. So, for example, if you have a big concern, you know, in the hiring process is that humans are, you know, inherently can have biases. They prefer people who have gone to their alma mater, or they just have a certain idea of what somebody should look like when there's role, and it's not blatantly, you know, trying to be discriminatory, but there it is. And so the idea is that if you're training an algorithm based on the people who have been promoted in the past, who have gotten raises in the past, who are, you know, doing well at a job for one reason or another, then that could bake in certain qualities that could potentially set you up for violating an anti-discrimination law, because algorithms look for patterns, you know, so they just might, they take a whole lot of information and kind of create this like idea of, but I'm not a technology person, so I'm not going to use the right words, but you know, they look for patterns, and the potential risk is that it could screen people out based on whether it's race or age or, you know, other or disability or other things that are protected by anti-discrimination laws, and that could potentially put employers at risk, although granted it's always very hard to prove that.
Tony, do you think a lot of employers, I imagine even huge employers like Amazon, certainly are considering those legal ramifications as well as they're thinking about these algorithms or these tests?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a couple of things to think about here. First of all, the testing that's being done are not algorithms that are based on past performance of employees. They're based on future performance on very specific skills. So if you look at the algorithms asking whether or not someone can code in a certain way or can connect the dots in a logistics issue a certain way, they're not based on how others have done it in the past. They're calculations. They're mathematical. So they do their best to remove bias that way. Now, that said, there is no question that implicit bias is a problem and an issue that every company is struggling with to make sure that they're hiring managers are, you know, acting on clear and rational and relevant data and not allowing their biases to come in. But I want to share one example of how technology eliminated this bias. Analytics is huge in HR right now, and every HR professional is doing their best to become math experts, even though most of them got into HR because they weren't math experts. But consider the case of a company that had a big college recruiting program. And every year they would go to the same colleges to do the same recruiting. And the colleges they selected were because they were the alma maters of their CEO and their CFO and their other executives. And so they were hiring at colleges where they didn't know if they were the right places to be. They were just going there because that's the bias of senior management. When they applied analytics, they found that their model needed to be flipped on its head, that the kind of elite schools that they had been going to, because that's where their senior executives went, the employees they hired lasted the shortest amount of period with the company and ended up the lowest rated for those who remained. On the other hand, employees they had hired from local community colleges and from other local state schools turned out to be the most loyal, best-performing employees they had. And they found that through using analytics. So it actually removed all biases, and they changed their recruiting process because the analytics showed that they were better off going to schools where that was more diverse and had a wider array of candidates.
We're talking about the technology and digitization of the job process with, that's Tony Lee with the Society for Human Resource Management. Alexia Elejalde Ruiz is also with us. She's a business reporter who first was reporting on this with the Chicago Tribune. Jeffrey Blumenfeld is with us as well, and he works to provide career counseling and exploration services. Jeff, I wanted to come back to you as we were just discussing this whole notion of tests and job processes and doing everything online. There is a certain level of digital savvy that is required with that. And I wonder what you're seeing with the folks that you're working with. If they don't have that level of comfort, are you concerned that they're now left out of a lot of opportunities within the labor market?
I think that you find the biggest disparity in an age group where those individuals have not grown up with technology, so that you are obviously looking at individuals that are probably 50 plus. And even though they have a certain comfort level with technology on a day-to-day basis, the learning curve is a greater learning curve. It's a slower curve for many individuals, although once they are up to speed in terms of whatever technology they're trying to acclimate to, they're absolutely every bit as good in terms of their skill sets as anyone else would be. But there is a different learning curve as a result of not growing up with technology and it not being something that they're as easily comfortable with as a younger group. So you do find that older individuals shy away from many of the means in which people could access employment as a result of their hesitancy to become involved with technology. And it's a real challenge for older workers to be able to move into certain spots in employment that are open to them, but because of their comfort level, it doesn't exist.
I wonder, Jeff, how much this is different, though, than the unfortunate, certainly, but very real age discrimination we've seen in the workplace. By and large, we hear lots of older workers talking about how hard it is for them to get jobs. Is this any different?
I think in some ways it is different because it's a matter of individuals basically confronting the fact that there are younger workers in the workforce that they need to learn to feel comfortable with. And I think most people that are older actually embrace that mixture of young and old in the workplace. There's a lot to be said for that mixture of what older workers bring to the workforce and what younger workers bring. So in that sense, I don't think it becomes as much an issue, but I think in the just purely acclimating technology, I think it is an issue in terms of their being able to, once again, to access jobs in the same way that perhaps younger workers would.
Just one last question for you, Jeff, then. How are you just doing practicing? Like, I wonder when you're working with people with career counseling, is it just a matter of getting them comfortable with this format and operating within this realm?
We spend a lot of time supporting our clients through the process of learning to interview, whether it's online, whether it's in person, whether it's over the phone, whether the phone is a screening or an actual interview. So there are many different ways in which we can support them in that process, and they can learn to certainly become more comfortable not only with the technology, but also with the process. It is a challenge, I would say that, and that it's not for everybody. There are certainly individuals, as I said before, that do shy away from it, and they will gravitate towards jobs that they can get the old-fashioned way by networking, by actually face-to-face interviewing and going through that process. But I would say that obviously those individuals who are open to learning and moving in that direction really reap the benefits of a much broader variety of job opportunities.
That's Jeff Blumenfeld with the Director of Career Moves at JVS Chicago. They provide career counseling and exploration services. I want to thank Tony Lee as well with the Society for Human Resource Management and, of course, the Chicago Tribune's Alexia Elejalde Ruiz for bringing this topic to our attention. Thanks for being with me, guys. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
I just wanted to update everybody. Yesterday on the program, we spoke with reporters from ProPublica, Illinois, about their recent investigation into possible incidents of abuse and negligence at children's shelters in the Chicago area. More than 100 immigrant children and teens separated from their parents at the border have been held in Chicago area shelters this year. Most recently, what we talked about yesterday, the nonprofit that runs these facilities in Illinois, Heartland Human Care Services, which is part of the Heartland Alliance, has been facing criticism over the past few weeks after the Washington Post first reported on some allegations of abuse. Yesterday, Heartland said they found no evidence to corroborate three different claims of physical abuse against migrant children. Officials said they conducted a two-week investigation over reports of abuse at its Casa Guadalupe shelter in the northwestern suburban Des Plaines. The Illinois Department of Children and Family Services is still conducting its own investigation. Coming up on the 21st, we're going to be talking to two Chicago entrepreneurs and how they've turned our Asian carp problem into a business. Stay tuned. You're listening to the 21st. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo, and if you live in Illinois, you probably heard of Asian carp. This invasive species of fish feed on plankton and dominate aquatic ecosystems by stealing food from our native fish populations. Plus, they have no natural predators, and experts worry about the impact they could have on our $7 billion fishing industry, especially if they get into the Great Lakes. Now, two Illinois natives are turning Asian carp from a nuisance into a niche market. Logan Honeycutt and Mike Cody are using Asian carp as the main ingredient in all natural treats for pets. Their company, Barrett All Pet Foods, launched back in 2015 and has now expanded to dozens of stores throughout Chicagoland as well as six other states. You can also buy their products online. Logan and Mike are on the line with me now to tell us more about how they're doing. Hi, Logan. Mike, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Logan, I wanted to start with you. How did you and Mike get the idea to use Asian carp for pet food?
So Mike and I, we went to college together, and we really bonded over fishing. That was one of our shared passions. And then once we both ended up here in Chicago, we went out fishing one day. And, you know, it's something that you'd always heard about. But until you see Asian carp in real life, it's almost a life-changing experience. So we got a real firsthand up close with Asian carp. And then we were both so disgusted by what we had seen that we were like, okay, we've got to do something about this. And we had been talking about using them in our product or getting into the pet industry. And then we decided that would be a perfect fit and use for it to try and create and leverage a marketplace in order to decrease their population.
So Logan, how is it life-changing? I've seen videos of people when they're doing fishing tournaments and Asian carp jump. I don't know if any jumped into your boat or what happened.
We were just out on the water. And then a school of them started jumping around us. And they're actually pretty large fish. That's what people don't seem to realize is those fish that are jumping, they're 20, 30 pounds. So imagine you're on a boat going full speed and you get hit in the face with a 30-pound fish. It can be devastating. People have suffered severe injuries from these fish.
Mike, I wonder what you would say about the reputation for Asian carp and why people aren't more willing to eat it. I haven't tried it myself personally. I've read that it tastes similar to cod or maybe like crab meat. Have you tasted Asian carp?
I have on a number of occasions. There's actually a fish market in town that sells Asian carp burgers on the weekends. It's actually really delicious. If you get a chance to try it, I would highly recommend it. But it's not popular in the U.S. Carp's kind of a four-letter word. People think back to their grandmother's carp, where it just tastes like mud. It's a bottom feeder. But Asian carp are completely different species, completely different flavors. I mean, it's quite delicious. But it does have a lot of bones, and Americans are scared off by eating around bones. So it never took off here.
And now what about for pets, and in particular dogs? What have you guys found with dogs and what they think about Asian carp? Logan?
The dogs absolutely love it. As Mike was saying, it's got a very clean taste. And since they have a vegetarian diet, since they're eating that algae and plankton, it doesn't have that really fishy smell or flavor. So dogs have just been going absolutely nuts for it from a palatability perspective. And one of the major benefits for our pets, a lot of people don't know, since they're vegetarians, they have lower heavy metal counts like mercury and arsenic than most any other pet or fish protein source, specifically because of their vegetarian diets. So it makes it a wonderful alternative for pets and for humans.
So when we think about that, Mike, I wanted to ask you about the name of your company. It's called Barrett All Pet Foods. Why did you all choose that name?
Well, we wanted something a little bit different. It speaks to the honesty and transparency we want to come across. We know the industry is kind of rife with greenwashing. People use all these buzzwords. All natural has become a big one. Everyone says their products are all natural. So we want people to actually know what's in their food, why it's there. So we put all the ingredients right on the front of the package. On the back, we put all the vitamins and minerals that are in there. And then we tell the consumer what those vitamins and minerals actually do for their pet. So we break it all down. We're all honest and transparent about what's in there and why.
So what else is in there, Mike? So Asian carp, what else do you put into the Barrett All Pet Foods?
Well, we follow the pantry principle. So we use things that would be in your own house, chickpeas, mango, flaxseed, blueberries, things that are definitely just things you'd see every day in your own own kitchen or in the grocery store that have a real benefit for the pets.
And Logan, how do you all go about sourcing all of the Asian carp? Are they all from caught here in Illinois?
Yep. Most of our fish comes from the Morris, Illinois area. It's about 40 miles southwest southeast of Chicago. So we actually work with local fishermen, and this was a really nice side benefit once we were figuring out our supply chain. Turns out that most commercial fishermen in Illinois have been put out of business by Asian carp. So now we actually get to pay them to go out and fish for them. And so they get some semblance of their jobs back. And our goal long term is once we create enough demand to have these fishermen going out all the time to, specifically for our products. So it creates a nice circular effect.
We're talking to Logan Honeycutt and Michael Cody. They're the co-founders of Barrett All Pet Foods. We've been talking about the Asian carp that they use to put into treats for pets. Mike, what kind of volume of Asian carp are you guys talking about then that are you bringing in to put into the food? I don't know. Logan was talking about how big the fish are to begin with. So I wonder what kind of volume you all are purchasing from fishermen.
Sure. We're still relatively small, but we're taking in around 10,000 pounds a month. So it adds up. Once we get into some of the other products we've been discussing and researching, that number will definitely go up. And as we grow, we'll keep removing those products, those fish from the waterways. We like to look at it as the number of fish we're preventing from getting into the system in the first place. So we assume half of them are females, and they lay about 4 million eggs twice a year. So we're preventing astronomical amounts of these Asian carp from getting born into the system, not just removing them from the waterways currently, but preventing that destruction in the future as well.
Logan, are you worried about exhausting the supply of Asian carp? That's probably not possible at this point, is it?
No, we get asked that question all the time. People say, well, what happens when you run out of your protein source? My answer is always, well, I'll expect to get a Nobel Prize for that. At this point, there's really nothing that we can do to completely eradicate them. We just have to create balance in order to give native species a chance to rebound. Because as you mentioned right at the beginning, they have no natural predators. So there is no consumption vehicle to control their populations. And that's where humans, we have to step in and do something about this. So, and the only way to do that is to generate demand. And the pet industry is the perfect place to do that.
That's Logan Honeycutt. He's the CEO and co-founder of Barrett All Foods, along with Michael Cody, talking to us about their Illinois-based pet food company that's launched 2 years ago and is now expanded. So you guys are available in stores throughout Chicagoland. Michael, online as well. People can buy if they're outside of the Chicago area?
That's correct. You can buy them on Amazon currently and our own website, BarrettAllPetFoods.com.
Thanks for being with me, guys. I appreciate it.
Yeah, we really enjoy being on and appreciate you helping us raise awareness about the massive issues that these fish are causing.
Yesterday, I got this voicemail.
Hi, I'm calling with Heartland to thank you for all your previous blood donations and to ask for your support again. To schedule your next...
If you've donated blood, maybe you get a lot of these calls too, and perhaps you ignore them. But this summer, there's a real need for blood donations, as often happens during the summer months. And joining me now in studio here in Urbana to explain more is Ashley Morgan with Community Blood Services of Illinois. Hi, Ashley. Thanks for being here.
Hi, how are you?
Great, Ashley. I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about how blood donations are going right now. Is there more of a need in the summer months and why?
Sure. Yeah, so there is more of a need in the summertime because we depend on high schools and colleges a majority of the time for blood donations because it's big populations. And obviously, over the summer, school is out, and that's about 15 to 20% of our blood donation. So we are looking for more donors to come in over the summer. You have to think of things like, you know, we're in the Midwest. The weather's fairly nice over the summer. So people are planning their vacations. They're gone a lot. And so while they might be a regular blood donor throughout the what we'll call school year, they might not remember to come and donate over the summer if they are back in town. So we're just looking to bring more donors in over the summer.
And when we think about the need, is there an increased need in the summer, or is it just that there's a decreased amount of people donating?
So the hospital need always, it remains the same all the time, right? So the number one use of our blood products is to treat patients with cancer. So that doesn't fluctuate necessarily just because of the summer. And, you know, we have blood on the shelves at our local hospitals that we supply. It's not that it's a shortage. When we say, when you want it, when people say that, you think there's no blood at all. Well, that's not the case with community blood services. We do have blood on the shelves to supply to our hospitals. We are just encouraging donors to come in so we can continue to have that blood on the shelves and maintain that steady blood supply.
And what does the need look like across the state? Is it, are there varying needs depending on the location?
It can depend on the location. You know, like I said, the number one use of our blood products is to treat patients with cancer. So cancer is something that is ongoing. Patients are always being treated for that. But we think of other things like other transfusions for trauma situations or regular blood diseases, you know. So if there is a trauma situation, that is unexpected. That is something we don't know that could happen. And that can happen all over the state. It's not, you know, just localized here. It can happen all over. So that's why you want to ensure that the blood is always on the shelves.
And you all serve, you mentioned hospitals. So are you all, does Community Blood Services of Illinois, is your job to get the blood to hospitals and to how many hospitals across Illinois?
Yeah. So across, well, in our whole service region, it's around 86 hospitals. But with Community Blood Services, we supply east through Danville, west through the Quad Cities and Macomb, and then north and south, Belleville to Galena. So there's a lot of hospitals in between here locally, Urbana, Carl and Presence are who we supply. And then also we supply majority hospitals in Springfield, Illinois as well.
So can you remind us now about who can donate blood and restrictions? I know particularly in the past couple of years, there were concerns about Zika and other blood-borne diseases and people traveling to places like Mexico or Florida.
Sure.
What does that look like right now?
So you can be 16 years old to donate with the consent form. 17 and older, you are good to go. When it comes to deferrals for, like you said, Zika or travel restrictions, Zika, it's not as prominent as it was before. They've kind of gotten a hang on that and testing for that. But when it comes to travel, there are certain areas that can keep you deferred from traveling. There might be certain places in Mexico, something maybe like the Dominican Republic on vacation. So if you are concerned about that, you've been somewhere, you can always call the donor center and we can tell you if that place you have traveled does have a restriction on it.
And where, when we think about particular, there aren't particular parts of the state that need it more than others right now, right?
Not necessarily, no.
Where can people go to donate blood? I think lots of people are also used in the summer to people coming to their place of employment or, as you're saying, high schools and colleges.
Sure.
Where else can you go?
So you can come to the donor center. So like I said, locally right here in Urbana, we're at 1408 West University Avenue. We're right in front of OSF Medical Center. So we have a donor center right there. And you can go online to bloodcenter.org to find out a donation center near you or wherever you might be.
And so if we have folks listening all across the state. Do you have advice for people who are interested in maybe setting up a blood drive at their workplace?
Yeah,
what's
of course.
Involved with that?
So you can look up your local blood center. So just kind of Google where your local blood center is going to be. Find out who your provider is. You can reach out to them to host a mobile blood drive. So that could be like coming into your office and setting up inside or setting up a blood mobile as well.
That's Ashley Morgan. She's a donor relations consultant with Community Blood Services of Illinois. We will tweet out all of those links as well, Ashley. We'll also have them at our website. And just a reminder for everyone who is able, this is a good time to donate.
It is. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks for being with us, Ashley. That does it for us today. On tomorrow's program, we'll be speaking with Senator Tammy Duckworth. She's going to join us. We're also going to be talking about online reviews. Do you check online reviews before trying a new restaurant? Do you leave Yelp reviews yourself? We'd love to hear from you how important you think those reviews are. You can leave us a voicemail. Our phone number for our hotline is 217-300-2121. Again, that voicemail number is 217-300-2121. You can also send us an email at talk@21stshow.org. If you have the NPR One app, you can always download that from wherever you get your smartphone apps. You can always search for past shows there. It's pretty simple to download, set your home station, and if you search for the 21st to follow us, you can easily listen to past shows that way. It also interacts with your smart speaker if you have one of those. If you want to find us for podcasts, we're available on iTunes, Android, wherever you get your podcasts. If you follow us on Twitter, our handle is 21stshow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. When we're not on air, you can follow us for the latest in Illinois news. All those links, every other way to contact us, all you have to remember is our website, 21stshow.org. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Tyler Panlilio is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. See you back here tomorrow.